It is straight up at 8 o'clock. Welcome to a Monday edition of the Mornings with Ed show. Delighted to have you with us today. And it's always, for me, it's always a treat to talk to someone who's doing good somewhere. You know, a lot of times you have to talk to people who aren't doing great things. This morning, we feel really fortunate. We have author and inventor and Orange County local, for goodness sakes, Don Schoendorfer with us. Don has a book that he's written called Miracle Wheels. It's the story of a mission to bring mobility to the world. Don's nonprofit here is called Free Wheelchair Mission. He found his purpose on a trip to Africa and specifically Morocco. He hopes to serve marginalized people across the world. It started in his garage with 100 wheelchairs. And by 2005, they'd already distributed 100,000 wheelchairs worldwide. We welcome to the program this morning author, inventor, and Orange County local, Don Schoendorfer. Welcome this morning, Don. How are you?
Thank you, Ed. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. You have an amazing story. I read your book, and I thought, wow, this is a story that to be told, and the work that you do now is something we should all be proud of. Tell our audience first of all about the. I'm going to skip back and forth, but I want you to start telling our audience about the summer of 1979 and the lady in Morocco. And how seeing her affected you, please.
Yes, I hadn't been here more than about 5 hours. Hit the first town after crossing from Spain. My wife and I, it was called, the name of the town is Tetuan. We were definitely labeled as tourists, people following us around, you know, basically trying to sell stuff to us. And we went into a very small part of a very old part of the city. It's called the Medina, and that's where they probably built it 1,000 years ago during the Crusades. And that's where the commerce was. It's kept that way ever since. Stucco and mud buildings, a couple stories high, and a dirt road, and between the legs of a crowd walking down either direction on this narrow dirt road, I see a woman trying to get between the legs, and she's crawling on the ground, crawling on her stomach, and literally digging her fingers into the dirt and pulling herself on the ground. And people stepping over her like she was some kind of refuge. And she just looked at the ground, looked at her hands, and looked and probably was thinking, please don't step on me. Please don't step on me. And then she got to the other side, disappeared down an alley, and that was it. Probably took a whole 60 seconds to see that scene. And wow, you know, just off the plane from United States, what do we, you know, we're Americans. Right. What do we do about this? Right. And there's no place to buy a wheelchair in this city. And she was gone. We'd never be able to find her again. And, you know, it was like, even as alarming as what I just described, it was like nobody was wanting to help her.
Right.
I couldn't understand it. It took a while, and I had to meet people who knew life in a developing world. You know, that's life. You deal with it.
Right.
You know?
And I'm sorry, go ahead. Continue, please.
No, that's it. You just had to deal with it.
Right. And years later, while antiquing, you refurbished a Civil War era wheelchair. I'm curious as to how much time elapsed between Morocco and the bulb going off over the antique wheelchair that you refurbished at your house.
Well, that was about 10 years. And, you know, when I did refurbish this, we lived in Boston, and I had a lot of time in the winter to do things like that. But it was still, in my opinion, it was a work of art. It was in the living room, much to much consternation from my wife, who said, it doesn't belong here. But, you know, I spent so much time on it. But that still wasn't it. It was another decade before I decided to get into this. This business of providing mobility.
So even having the wheelchair chair, the bulb hadn't clicked yet. It took another several years. And you called a wheelchair company looking for wheels at one point. When you called and told them that you were wanting to give wheelchairs away in developing nations, you were not getting callbacks, correct?
No, it was too confusing. I mean, first of all, why do you want to do this? Second of all, there's liability issues with wheelchairs. And third of all, you know, why would we want to help somebody who could be a competitor to us?
Right.
You know, and we later found out that there are nobody selling wheelchairs in these countries because nobody has any money to buy them. So there's no way we would be a competitor.
So you took your knowledge, your engineering knowledge, and I wanted to let the audience know that as a kid, you had a three-wheeled go-kart, and then you upgraded the go-kart pretty much on your own along with your father, and you got an Erector set for Christmas. If you could tell us how that Erector set and a white plastic chair of all things influenced your improvement of not only the go-kart, but the eventual vision for the design of wheelchairs that you give away across the world.
Well, it's amazing what you can do with a 1.5 horsepower lawnmower engine as a kid. And my father was a machinist for the New York Central Railroad, so he could have things made for me. So I would make drawings, and he would take the drawings, and he would say, "Don, are you sure this drawing is correct?" And I'd say, "Well, I think so. It looks good." He'd come back with a part that just totally was wrong. And I learned how to do mechanical drawings because he said, "Don't give up. These machinists want to help you because, you know, they know what you want to do." But and then I got this thing on with four wheels. And, you know, there was a time when, you know, it would be nice not to just sit on a plank of plywood. They actually were making prototypes of these common white resin launchers back in the late 60s, early 60s, late 50s. And so I, you know, it seemed to fit. I just saw the legs off, and there I was, a plastic chair on a homemade wooden go-kart. And I would grew up in a very small town in Ohio where you could do things like ride your go-kart and just try to dodge the police when they saw you coming.
So I found your story when you were a kid of finding the MIT ad in the New York Times, and your subsequent letter to MIT, fascinating, something that dreamers can identify with and also agonize over. Talk to us about that.
Well, my parents, we moved to Ohio from New York area. I was born in Albany, and they just couldn't give up the New York Times Sunday edition. And they'd get to the train just when it was dropping off from the train going to Chicago, and they'd drop off the Sunday edition, and they'd bring it home and then devour this. And this happened to see in a magazine section an article about MIT saying that it was the finest engineering school in the world. And I said, "Mom, you know, I think I'd like to go there." She, rather than say, roll her eyes and say it's crazy, she said, "Well, why don't you write them and see if you can get some information from them?" And so I did, but I never got a reply. And when I think about what I did years later, I knew they were in Cambridge, but I probably didn't know they were in Massachusetts. So I probably wrote the letter to the MIT, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, thinking that it was like Ashley Bureau, like all you have to do is get your street and the postman knows where you live, right?
Right. You think everyone would know where MIT was.
You'd think so, but evidently in Boston, they didn't have the time for this. So then I became determined. I'm saying, I'm going.
Right.
And that's what happened.
Everything you've done, from what I read in the book, everything you've done took a lot of determination. You talk about your parents not having a lot, but being very generous with what they did have. My parents were very much the same. I'm curious, in your pursuit of filling the wheelchair needs of what 75 million people across the world, I think I'm going to ask you a question about the human condition here. Any billionaire could easily help fund this worthy project with just a tiny fraction of their wealth. Have you approached any billionaires to help? Have any reached out and offered help? Or has this been funded mostly by people with modest means?
Well, It was 1983, we moved to California, and that was in pursuit of my own approach to become a billionaire, you know, thinking, just as a biomedical engineer, I could help, you know, invent something and start a company. And, you know, I was a very happy engineer inventor in the back room, and I was making companies very wealthy, the ones I worked for, and that was fair. That was what they paid me for. Mm-hmm. I haven't met any billionaires who just want to write a check. Having started Free Will at Your Mission, I've met a lot of very generous people in Southern California. I go to a church called Mariners Church. You're familiar with that, I'm sure.
Yeah, Newport Beach, right? Yeah.
Right, and the people that are very generous there and very thoughtful, very worldly, and I've gotten a lot of support from people who send a few dollars a month, and people say, well, what does a container cost? A container of these wheelchairs. And I tell them, and they say, well, here's enough for two containers. And I say, wow, that's really, so that's how it's all come in. Okay. All the funding.
All right. And I want to talk for a moment about MIT and your work. I really want to talk about your research. In this is completely a side subject. This is just something that fascinated me from the book that I really didn't get an answer to that I'd like to hear from you. In 1975, you were part of an MIT team that tested artificial vocal cords. How did those experiments end?
Well, I actually was able to. I record a person's speech before they had the laryngectomy, with their voice box taken out. And this was because of cancer, or because back then they didn't have seat belts, and you'd hit the steering wheel with your throat on a collision, and that would be it. MIT was working really hard to try to, with the Bell-Tel Laboratories grant to, you know, automate operators, so they'd have to hire operators. They could have artificial speech. So there was a fantastic laboratory that I used to try to figure out what was going on with this vocal cord in the first place and how to simulate it with something very similar to a duck call. Right. And found a surgeon in Buffalo, New York, Roswell Park, who was able to figure out how to get this appliance, this very small appliance, into the base of the vocal tract for the laryngectomized patient. And lo and behold, their voice was different after the operation, after they healed, and after we inserted the device. But, you know, they could talk, and they were totally amazed because they figured they never would again. And I thought that was going to be a great thing, and the MIT thought it was great enough. They even got a patent on it. But then I realized, you know, this surgeon in Buffalo, New York, was very gifted. And oncologists and cancer surgeons, their goal is to remove cancer.
Right.
And secondarily, they think about rehab of a patient after the cancer is removed. They want to. They just want to keep the patient alive. And no one was willing to take the extra 4 to 5 hours in performing this fairly complicated surgery. So the idea wasn't going to go anywhere. It hasn't gone anywhere since. Right. It's still this way. Mm-hmm. But it's sad, but I had to move on.
Yeah, it was noble work. Thank you. Thank you for the noble work there. And of course, all the noble work you do. I have one more story that I need to ask you about here. And I want you to tell me if I interpreted this story right as I read it in the book, part of your medical research. In 1999, you were looking at medical diagnostic technologies, working on blood cell separation. And you had a patented patch technology that detected alcohol in the blood. And at the time, 3M was bankrolling your research. Am I reading it correctly that they pulled the rug out from under? They wanted their money back, knowing you couldn't pay it, so they took the patents?
Well, that sounds like you're 3M is an evil, mean company, and they certainly weren't. What happened was that they were fascinated by this idea. Right. It was a Band-Aid you could put on your skin. You could wear it for a day, a week, or a month. Right. And MIT is really good at making adhesive bandages that'll stay on that long. And they learned how to keep it on the skin and not have it be an irritant to the wearer. And so they funded us, and it took, what's really what happened, it took us almost 6 years to convince the FDA that this was a reliable product.
Right.
Because they didn't have a sweat department. The FDA had a urine department, and they had a blood department, and they didn't have anything in diagnostics for sweat. So by the time we finally got approval for this, we had spent all our money. And we tried to sell this to the big diagnostic companies, and they already were, making money hand over fist with blood and urine. They didn't need a third diagnostic fluid,
right.
Sweat.
Right.
And we couldn't convince MIT. We couldn't convince 3M we had much of a future. So they said, it's only fair. We want to hold the patents because maybe somebody will make this work, and then you could walk away from this and you don't have to pay us back.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was my last attempt at trying to become a billionaire.
Well, I've got to say, I like the turn that you took. If you're not going to be a billionaire, then certainly helping hundreds of thousands of people across the world is got to be much more satisfying. How many people have you put in wheelchairs across the world?
It's over 1.3 million so far.
My goodness. My goodness. And it started with just 100 in your garage.
Yes, I had to build a prototype. All my years as an engineer and an inventor, I knew that I couldn't convince anybody of anything without something they could get their hands on, right. A prototype. And I made the first one. It was Toys R Us, got bicycle wheels, Home Depot, all in Irvine, Tustin area. I got the chairs. I made a sample, took it to Mariners Church. Had an appointment with the missions outreach pastor,
right.
Skip Landfried. He was very tired and bleary-eyed when I met him that morning because he had just got off a plane from Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Right.
And I wheeled out this thing and showed him, and he said, "Don, you can't believe it. 2 days ago, while I was on the way to the plane in Democratic Republic of the Congo, I saw people crawling on the ground. And here you are, 2 days later, showing me what they needed."
Right.
It was a lawn chair with mountain bike tires.
And as I look, that's generation one. So you've retired the first generation model of wheelchairs with the white resin chairs. And then you, in 2012, came up with the second generation. And now you're in a third generation of wheelchairs. Is that correct?
Yes. The first generation was simple, and it was good for an adult, especially of one that didn't need a lot of support because of their disability. But we could not make any really adjustments to it, how it fit. And what we learned is that it's good medicine, and it's also just practical. Like if I were to give you a pair of shoes, brand new, really shiny, $300, $400 pair of shoes, you'd be happy, especially if you didn't have any shoes at all.
Right.
And you'd smile as I tried to put them on your feet, but they'd be so tight. You'd smile until I left, and you take them home, and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do with these because they're too tight. You can't wear them.
Right.
And the wheelchair is the same way. If it's not comfortable, the person is not going to use it. And it's a great medical benefit if you make it comfortable because that you want them to be able to use a chair. So we need to include a lot of the adjustments that you see in conventional U.S. wheelchairs. But then we went a little further because you start to see disabilities, it changes in bodies. There's severe differences in the length of legs and the tilt of the ankle, and the hip structure and the bone structure. So we had to adjust the width of the chair, the height of the backrest, the wheel, the footrest, and all this. And we were able to do this and keep the cost low enough that we could continue to give them away.
Right. Now, you mentioned keep the cost low enough. What does it cost to make a Generation 3, and comparatively, what was the cost to make the first generation?
Well, the first one was, I found a factory in China to make the first prototypes, and I asked them, could you make it under $30? And sure enough, they came back $29.95.
Of course.
And of course, yeah, I should have said $20. They probably would have come up with something, too. But that was just the chair in China. And so now what we do, and we fund this by donations,
right.
We can have a chair made in either China or in India. It goes into a container like the ones you see being pulled along the 405 from Long Beach, ocean ship container that holds 550 wheelchairs or 530, depending on which size you order. And we can have them made, shipped, delivered to an ocean port, and they're unloaded. We surrender the contents of the container to a distribution partner who I can talk about if you ask.
Yeah.
But somebody who's going to take the work of distributing these wheelchairs. And they're offloaded from the container. They're unpacked from the into a storage area. They find the people. They find the ones who are appropriate for the chairs we offer. They bring the chair to these people, either one at a time or maybe groups of 30 or 50 or 100. And they get volunteers all along the way to help them. And they assemble the chairs. We train them how to assemble the chair. We train, and then they know how to make the adjustments. Right. And they train people how to use the chair. And we can do all that for $96.
There you go. There you go. And when you talk about partners in many communities, like in Peru, for instance, there was a church within the community. Is that correct?
Yes, I got a call from Pastor Robert Berenger, who was grew up in Santa Monica, and he had heard about the wheelchairs, and he called and said, "Do you have any?" I said, "You know, how many do you want?" And he said, "Well, we 50 or 60. He said, "No, I can only give you 550, because that's how we ship them."
Right.
And he's okay. And so within a couple months, he had the first container, and he made the mistake of advertising that he was going to give them away. And it was in the local papers in the suburb of Lima.
Right.
And everybody was all excited. This was going to be a big deal. He had 100 of the chairs all ready to go. And there was the mayor and there were people from the press. And they had a little podium built out of 2x4s so they could stand, get up over the crowd. And he's ready to take the microphone. And he sees what he figured was about 6,000 people crawling on the ground to get the wheelchair. And as he said, this was going to be the happiest one and probably the happiest day of my life. And it turned out to be one of the saddest days of my life because I had to explain, you know, we only have 100 right here. We'll get your names. We'll get back to you, but we can't do it today.
Right.
You can't advertise.
Right. And turning away desperation is got to be tough on the soul. It's got to be tough on the heart. Tell us, if you will, how we can help the most, how our listeners can help. I can tell you right now, they can go to freewheelchairmission.org, or you can check the book out at miraclewheels.org. Are there other ways that we could help? Are there other things you're looking for us to do to help?
Well, you know, your listeners are very close to my home is in Santa Ana. Our office is in Irvine near the Spectrum. We do many things locally where we have just people. One of the things that's coming up and probably in May is Run for Mobility, where we have we partner with the Marathon, Orange County Marathon. And, you know, it's not just you just have to run, but we have people just do things for mobility. You can walk, you can paddle a canoe, you can climb a mountain. And people have come up with all kinds of other ideas that they use to move for somebody who can't. We also have with our office, we need volunteers to help. You know, we just send out scads of Christmas cards. You donate a Christmas card. You send a Christmas present to somebody, and you don't know what, but there's a Christmas card, and you can send it, and it costs what the price of a wheelchair, $96. But then you get a chance to figure out what continent the chair is going to, and so you're happy because you gave somebody something useful.
Right.
They're
right.
Happy because they don't have to make an excuse for another ugly tie. Because they really feel like they've given something to somebody for that's going to be useful. And then best of all, someone's going to get a wheelchair. Someone's going to get off the ground. And that's a big project for us. We need lots of help doing that. We sometimes get people to come on mission trips with us.
Okay.
We had to stop that during the COVID era, which we hope is past us, but we'll be stopped doing that. We'll be starting that again in June, I think, saying people, you know, we want them to help raise what it would cost to send the container. And churches do it, and organizations do it, and then you get to go with some of you get to go with us, and we see how we give these chairs away. And, you know, literally, when you have a chance to pick somebody up off the ground, and they maybe have given up, even praying for a wheelchair. And they could have been born this way, or it could have been a recent accident, because there's no guardrails in developing countries. There's many accidents that take out mobility. But all of a sudden, that day comes, and you knock on the door, and they're very confused. Their family's very confused. You put them in the chair. And when you see them, they see your feet first, right?
Right.
And then you pick them up, and they're not very heavy because a lot of their muscles have atrophied because of lack of use for their disability. And you put them in a wheelchair, and you stand back, and they don't even look the same because they're looking at you eye to eye now.
Right.
And they're crying, and their family's crying because their family was their wheelchair. All up to since whenever it was, they lost their ability. When they had to go to the bathroom, when they needed a clothes change, when they needed food, their family was taking care of them because they wouldn't have lived on their own. And then you see this whole change in a matter of minutes. It's like that's why we call it miracle wheels.
Right.
To them, it's a miracle. They can't explain it. And we tell them, when in countries where this can be done. And we tell them, you know what? We're just messengers. Our partners are just messengers. This wheelchair is coming from God, who loves you, who doesn't see you cursed. Like, this is what you heard all this time, because everywhere in the world, people claim that they explain disability with it's a curse.
Right.
Something happened in your past. He loves you, and he wants you to feel like you're in his hands. When you're in your brand new wheelchair.
Don, I got to tell you, on behalf of a very grateful community of listeners, thank you for the nobility of your work, and thank you for what you're doing. The book is Miracle Wheels. It's the story of a mission to bring mobility to the world. The website you can check it out on is miraclewheels.org, as well as freewheelchairmission.org. Once again, freewheelchairmission.org. Don, I'm going to have you hang on the line when we're done, and I see us talking again down the road. I can't wait to have you in studio, and can't wait to help you any way that we can here. Thank you so much for being part of the program this morning.
Oh, thank you very much. It's just great to tell the story.
Great conversation, Don. We'll look forward to talking to you again. 8:27 the time. It's the Mornings with Ed Show.